Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 280, Zabebu's Mantlakazi Shatter Tsechwai Zosutu, setting off the Zulu Civil War. On the afternoon of the 10th of January, 1883, King Tsechwai Khampande climbed off a skiff and onto the beach at Port Durnford, surviving the heavy and powerful surf. The British had been using this stretch of desolate sand as their transport hub into Zululand, which is south of the modern harbour of Richards Bay. At the time, Richards Bay was called Umhlathuzi Lagoon. It was far too shallow for the British ships to enter. It was also dominated by a sandbar. In 1883, there was no dredging going on. Tsechwai had boarded the Natal, a large British steamship in Cape Town. 4 days later, he was close to home, but the vessel anchored offshore in the deep water, just outside the terrifying breaker line, where the waves crest and foam. Next, the crew lowered heavy specialized surf boats into the water alongside the steamship. These were large, thick wooden rowboats built specifically to survive being tossed around by violent ocean waves. King Tsechwai and his small traveling party had to climb down the side of the Natal using ladders and ropes and then step into the rocking surf boat. To make sure the boats did not flip or get swept away by the current, the British used a system of heavy ropes called warp lines. A thick, strong rope was tied tightly between the anchored steamship out at sea and heavy wooden posts buried deep in the sand on the beach. Instead of just relying on oars, the sailors in the surf boat would grab onto this long rope and pull the boat forward along the line. They kept the boat pointed straight into the crashing waves, preventing the dangerous sideways that turned the boats over. As the surf boat approached the shore, it hit the most dangerous part of the journey, the breaking surf, which was famously known as a wet ride. Giant walls of white water would smash against the boat, soaking everyone on board. Sailors had to use all their strength to keep the boat steady along the rope, while the waves violently lifted and dropped them. Once the boat cleared the heaviest waves and hit the shallow water, it would grind to a halt on the wet sand. Waves would still be swirling violently around the hull. Before the next could pull the boat back out to sea, British soldiers and local workers waiting on the beach rushed into the waist-deep water, grabbed the sides of the heavy surf boat, and pulled it as far as possible up onto the dry sand. When King Tsechwai stepped out of the wet boat onto the sand of Durnford, he was formally met by British official Sir Theophilus Shepstone to begin his return to Zululand. Tsechwai looked around. There was no welcoming committee of his people. Shepstone had purposefully kept the date of the king's return a secret, this after 3 years in exile. It was just the sort of thing at which Theophilus excelled, a thoughtful deviousness. The British brought him back to lead a detachment of 6th Dragoons to greet the old Zulu king and to escort Tsechwai back to Umthonjaneni above the Amakosini Valley, which they did. Shortly after they arrived in early January, Mantlakazi leader Zabebu came to Umthonjaneni, but not to pay respects to Tsechwai. He made a grand point of greeting Shepstone, his patron, ignoring the king. Zululand had been fractured. Tsechwai now led a broken people, where the different regions were alienated from royal control. Tsechwai had indeed been restored, but his country was divided. The Usutu regiment in particular were aghast. They were forced to remain under Zabebu's rule. He was a tyrant, hated. Misgivings galore. The chiefs gathered at Umthonjaneni on the 29th of January, many suffering under a bizarre illusion that Tsechwai was actually a waxwork image, an isitombe, bought by the British and set up far away enough to appear human. At least that's what Zabebu had snidely suggested. 6,000 prominent Zulus from across the territory attended, and it wasn't until Tsechwai stood up and walked towards them that they were convinced he was indeed real. For the previous 12 months, a game of smoke and mirrors had confounded the king. When he returned from visiting Queen Victoria in England in September 1882, he'd been told he was to return home almost immediately. The actual boundaries of his kingdom were undefined. Natal officials were terrified of Tsechwai, sure that he would invoke the spirits of Dingana and Shaka, and that the Zulu would rise up once again. They wanted to confine Tsechwai to the central portion of his former kingdom, where he could be managed by a resident supervisor, who was Henry Francis Finn, Jr. Tsechwai's southern border was the Umhlathuzi River, Further south was territory controlled by John Dunn's chieftains, along with those who answered to Chief Hlubi. This area was really a military buffer zone for Natal and a sanctuary if Zulus wished to avoid Cetshwayo's rule, and initially planned to be administered directly by the British authorities and called the Reserve. What transpired was British administrators were recruited from Natal settlers, and it was further decided to fund the resident commissioner and the sub-commissioners, as well as friendly chiefs, through a hut tax, a hated tool of colonialism. This was not the agreement Cetshwayo had reached. The reality was, it was a full-blown Shepston system, as historian John Labunt calls it, where settler control would be extended over the entire southern third of Zululand, and the British would actually take a back seat to the settler administration. In the north, Zibebu, Cetshwayo's implacable enemy, would rule independently, the only independent chief out of the 13 selected by the British to rule over different territories in Zululand. Zibebu took control over the land north of the Black Mfolozi, land which was dominated by pro-Cetshwayo loyals, and Zibebu was distinctly anti-Cetshwayo. Zululand Special Commissioner Sir Henry Bulwer instructed British resident Melmoth Osborne to readjust Zibebu's borders to allow the leading members of the Usutu cause to return to their own homes. They too had an implacable enemy, which was Zibebu, and they were Cetshwayo royalists. Witnessing all of these territorial shenanigans were Bishop Colenso and his daughters, Frances and Harriet. They had been endlessly warning about the danger of civil war should the British continue with their plan to shatter Zululand into 13 different chiefdoms, but they were ignored. Limp-wristed liberal humanists, it was accused, to be sneered and scoffed at, which of course was a mistake, as you'll hear. Osborne had started his career in colonial administration in 1854 when he had entered the Natal Civil Service at the age of 20. He was a tried and tested Shepston man, heavy set with an impressive beard, imbued with a large and fleshy nose, fluent in isiZulu, and he had a firm grasp of Zulu culture and cosmology, the rituals. He suffered, however, from the ideological illness that afflicts many in state functions. He was hopelessly biased and a Natal partisan. He was hardly likely to support the Usutu faction against antagonistic chiefs like Zibebu. In fact, he was hell-bent on destroying the Usutu, one of the regiments at the core of the British Empire's battle losses in Zululand. Osborne welcomed a chance to support Zibebu in his ill treatment of the royal family and their close associates like Mnyamana and of the Usutu generally. Bulwer suggested that the western and southern portions of Zibebu's original territory be chopped away and added to the land under Cetshwayo's rule, further exacerbating tension. Who lived where? Someone needed to decide. Into the spotlight steps one of those gentlemen of the 19th century who wielded both innovative technology and untold influence, the land surveyor. John Eustace Fannin was picked for the job, having worked for many years measuring land around Durban and then the Kimberley diamond fields. Fluent in Zulu and useful as an intelligence operative during the Anglo-Zulu War, he set to work immediately in 1882. 4 years earlier, Captain James Alain had surveyed Zululand as part of the initial peace settlement, and as Fannin trundled around the region in his wagon, using his theodolite from hill to hill, across rivers and valleys, he came across the beacons Alain had left. Some were rock cairns, others chiseled rocks, a simple capital B indicating that it was a beacon. Other beacons were piles of stones. Fannin came across a cabbage tree with a large B cut in its bark, with a pile of stones surrounding the trunk. He also used natural features such as flays, ponds, and hilltops. After a few weeks, it became apparent that he could not stick to Bulwer's instructions, ensure that Zibebu's territory was a compact triangular shape. Instead, he took the lead from Captain Alain's exploits and followed topographical features as well as social realities rather than just drawing an abstract triangle on a map. By the time he finished, at least 40 homesteads belonging to Zibebu's Mantlakazi were now placed in Usutu territory. Seemingly satisfied, Fannin returned to Natal to take up his new job, resident magistrate of Stanga. It was into this newly divvied up landscape that Cetshwayo returned in early 1883. Shepstone officiated over the handing over of power and once again was forced to face a plethora of complaints delivered by the king's men, including Mnyamana's Nduna Hemulana. The king's restoration, he said, was a disgrace. Ever the thin-skinned settler, Shepstone was outraged. He was merely a clerk sent by the British to dot a few I's and cross a few T's. He had no power to alter any of the conditions. After the tongue-lashing by the king's men, he and the dragoons hurried back to the safety of Natal, muttering about the insults they'd been forced to endure. With stuffy old Shepstone gone, the Zulu let their hair down. Let the party begin. But the reality of his situation was clear to Cetshwayo. While his homestead at Ondini had been reinstated, it was east of the original town burned down by the British. It was smaller. Still, almost 1,000 huts were built in the traditional style of an ikanda with the izugodlu at the top, all protocols observed. Well, almost all. A large number of senior Ndunas and chiefs were absent. After Shepstone left, Zebebu left too. Hamu had stayed away. When Mfana Wendlela arrived, somewhat shamefaced, it was he, of course, who had committed the sacrilege of planting crops on King Mpande's grave on the Matlabatini plain. But things had changed, and when he walked into the Izugodlo, Mfana Wendlela did not prostrate himself before the Zulu king. He idled up to one of the chairs and sat down as if he was Cetshwayo's equal. Later, Mfana Wendlela would pay for this gross infringement when his crops were destroyed, some of his imizi burned down by the Usutu. As the king sought to rein in rebel chiefs, clashes began. This was counter to the promise Cetshwayo had made to the British authorities that he wouldn't seek war or raiding when he went home. But Labatini resident magistrate Henry Francis Finn became aware of the growing conflict. As a local, he was somewhat different to many Englishmen of Natal. Finn's knowledge of Zulu language, rituals and customs meant he understood more of the nuance of action than his peers. The Zulu respected him. His name was Gwala Gwala, named after the red feather of a luri worn in his hat. It was also the symbol of a hero. So he was now in an invidious position. He had met Cetshwayo way back in 1873. A decade of experience was being tested. His cordial relations with the Zulu king were strained, because Cetshwayo expected him to be a partisan supporter of the king's position. Soon reports emerged of more clashes in the northeast of the kingdom, where royalist Kulusi warriors, joined by the Mdlalozi, were fighting with Hamu's Ngenecheni. The Usutu and Zebebu's men were already quarrelling, but further south of the Mtlatuzi matters were more grave. The original plan was to move the king's supporters here across the river to the north, but they were loath to abandon their traditional homes and face the hardship of internal refugees. They opted instead to remain behind in the reserve territories, the land where chiefs like John Dunn ruled tense times. Tense times turned into full frontal warfare in March 1883. Zebebu had insisted that his subjects openly acknowledge his authority or move out of his territory, and he began to back up these threats with action. His warriors descended on the homesteads of those who vacillated. Blood began to flow once more. Back at Ondini, senior men Ndabuko, Mnyamana, and other chiefs from the north left Cetshwayo's side and headed home to deal with this new crisis. They wanted to mobilize their warriors to finish off Zebebu. Oral history suggests that Cetshwayo did not explicitly sanction this action, although it's hard to believe he would not have had his ear close to the ground. After all, Finn had warned Cetshwayo that an aggressive move would antagonize the British, and was himself picking up signs of conflict. The king must know. At first, the regiments that gathered near Mnyamana's home on the Sikwebezi River appeared motivated. Contingents of Ndabuko's Usutu and Maboko Masipula's Mgazini, the Buthelezi, who boasted Mnyamana's son Chani Bezwe as their leader, 5,000 men in total, who were then dotted with Muti. Their target was Mantlakazi Amabuto. Mnyamana had wisely advised waiting until they were reinforced by the Kulusi regiment, which was on its way, but Ndabuko was impatient. It was his nature. He had been impatient at Isandlwana too, leading the warriors across the Mzinyati River, then launching the abortive attack on Rourke's Drift, which had cost the Zulu 3,000 men. His hot-headedness was about to bring trouble upon his people once again. Ndabuko ordered Makoba Ka Mapita to take command of the loose grouping, which was not even properly organized as an Amabuto. Makoba was Zibebu's half-brother, but he was a royalist loyal to Cetshwayo. He advanced eastwards into Zibebu's territory between the Msebe and Mkuzi rivers, his column 30 men wide, stretching for several kilometres. But appearances can be deceptive, because a large portion of this force consisted of young boys, the unarmed Ubidi, who carried food and the sleeping mats and spare weapons. This ragtag army marched northeast towards Zibebu's Banga Normal homestead, plundering and burning as it went, destroying all Umizi belonging to the Mantlakazi chief. Despite the apparent voracious appetite for destruction, the morale of this army was shaky. As they strode deeper and deeper into enemy territory, there was no sign of the defenders. Zibebu and his 1,500 men, on the other hand, were very motivated. They were part of a single Amabutho, much more cohesive than the jumbled rabble that approached, although fewer in number. The disorderly Usutu, approaching Banga Normal, just south of where Pongolapoort Dam is today, were also going to face Boer mercenaries, six heavily armed burghers, including Johan Kolenbrander. That Boer had sold Zibebu hundreds of firearms over the years and helped transport them from the Portuguese-controlled Lorenzo Marques. He was a useful mercenary to have around. Glancing at a Google map will help you visualize the approach. It's not far from Ulundi to Banga Normal, approaching along river valleys, deeply wooded ravines, rocky hills. The slopes meant that an army inside these watercourses along the Msebe River would not be able to see any great distance, and the long grass and mimosa trees concealed the 1,500 warriors under Zibebu's command, who were now stretched across Makoba Ka Mapita's path. Soon after sunrise, on March the 30th, 1883, a group of Usutu stopped to eat looted mealies near the burned Nkukwini homestead, when six of Zibebu's warriors, who were mounted, galloped into view and fired a few shots at the looters. They charged off, followed closely by the Usutu section. As the Boers had learned many decades earlier, when a group of Zulu warriors entice you into a deep river valley, you reconsider your actions pretty quickly. It was obviously a trap, but Usutu blood was up, and they were off. Zibebu watched them from a hill to the north, and then said, "It is now favorably placed. Strike its head." Cetshwayo's snake had slithered into an ambush. Mantlakazi Mabuta fell on the Mgazini Mabuta, which broke. The royalists fled. The other sections of the Usutu had no idea what was going on. The broken ground meant they couldn't see over the nearest hill. But they heard the sound of battle, then the obvious sound of retreat, and they panicked. The Buthelezi section broke and ran, leaving the best disciplined Usutu to face the deadly music. Soon, though, they broke too, and were routed. The Mantlakazi opened fire with the imported rifles. Others stabbed at the retreating men, who were desperately trying to reach the Nongoma hills to the west. Some sprinted off north, towards the Transvaal border. Zibebu, meanwhile, had fallen off his horse, a magnificent white steed, but he managed to remount and then charge the fleeing Usutu, picking them off with his rifle. He intervened when he spotted one of Mnyamana's sons surrounded by his men, and interrogated the terrified youngster, who survived. The other man he spotted was Cetshwayo's brother, Siteku, who was also interrogated and allowed to live. But 10 other sons of Mnyamana were killed, as well as 5 of Ndabuko's. While Zibebu offered mercy to some of the royal blood, others were not so lucky. Zibebu sought vengeance on his brother, Makoba. He hunted him down on the battlefield, killed him, along with Mgwazeni of the Zungu, who was Cetshwayo's uncle, the brother of Zibebu's mother. In what was a completely one-sided affair reminiscent of some of the colonial battles, only 10 Mantlakazi died, but thousands of Usutu and their allies perished. The fight had only just begun, because the next day hundreds of Tsonga appeared from the east near Delagoa Bay, advancing over the Lebombo Mountains. They were also repulsed. Hamu now heard of Zibebu's stunning victory and joined in. Eventually, the royalists fled north over the Pongola to the South African Republic, the Transvaal, others south to Undini, some crossed the Black Mfolozi to the west and disappeared into the Ngomi forest. A handful made it up the mountains of Hlobane. Back in Pietermaritzburg, the Natal capital, the authorities were quick to blame the Usutu for the ill-considered rush to attack the Mantlakazi of Zibebu. Finn had warned Cetshwayo of the political danger of allowing the Usutu to commit to war. Now it backfired on the royalists. They forfeited the confidence of the British. Worse, it convinced Shepstone that he was right to oppose Cetshwayo's return to Zululand. The Zulu king's power had been further diminished in the eyes of his own people, particularly the proud Ndabuko, who had led so many battles and whose hot-blooded campaigns had driven his people now down a one-way road. Zibebu's ally Ingenechani joined Hamu. On the other side, the royalists gathered at Ondini, planning to counter the grave threat that had emerged from their northeast. In May, thousands of warriors walked to Cetshwayo's great place, summoned by the king. They gathered at Mahlabatini, along with the king's reserve, and were soon sent north to help defeat Hamu, who was defending his territory stoutly. The Mantlakazi of Zibebu continued their raiding. Hamu remained at large, and even Dubulumanzi's 3,000-strong Amabuto had been sent scurrying home by Zibebu's warriors. Cetshwayo turned to the warriors living on the border, the Usutu, who were unsure. Many decided to join with the king, but when he sent word further afield to the Swazi, Zibebu was tipped off and realized he could not wait. It was time for a dramatic direct assault on Cetshwayo's great place, Ondini. He gathered 3,000 crack warriors on the 20th of July, supported by 5 Boers. They met on the eastern slopes of the Nongoma Ridge at the Ikuvukeni homestead of an ally, and Cetshwayo's spies hurried to Ulundi to alert the king to the imminent danger. The Zulu king had gathered his senior councillors and indunas at Ondini. Cattle had been slaughtered for a feast. Beer had been brought out for the Usutu nobility. The king believed Zibebu wanted to head north once again to support Hamu against Mnyamana, and that he himself was in no grave danger. It was unthinkable that anyone, apart from the British and perhaps the Boers, would have the audacity to attack the king at his home. He underestimated Zibebu's daring. So Cetshwayo and his guests went back to their carousing, quaffing beers, eating their chisanyama until late that night. Then they slept. While they snored, the Mantlakazi crept through the broken ravines of the Black Mfolozi unseen. There were no homesteads on this broken ground, no living creatures except perhaps for wild animals. No human heard their approach. They stopped 5 kilometers from Ondini, hidden behind the hills to the east of Ulundi. There they made fires, the smoke unseen in the pitch-black night, warming themselves against the depth of winter. Then they continued towards Ondini. It is incredible what Zibebu's 3,000 troops had accomplished. They had not only escaped detention, they had walked 50 kilometers over difficult terrain. This had drained the warriors, and their chief was banking on a quick and nasty fight. Should they be defeated, it would be all over. They didn't have the energy to run away. Before dawn on July 21st, 1883, the brother of King Imbandeni of the Swazis was minding his own business at a small homestead east of Ondini, the Umuzi of Mfanawendlela, when he spotted the advancing Mantlakazi. He sent a runner towards Ondini, who arrived just after sunrise and woke Cetshwayo. Ripples of shock ran through the great place as the warriors formed up. Cetshwayo's many chiefs and councillors began to bicker amongst themselves instead of facing the clear and present danger. They told Cetshwayo to head for cover, but he snapped, "Am I to run away from my dog?" Cetshwayo turned to Sekatwayo of the Mdlalosi's brother, Ntuzwa, and ordered him to assume command of the Amabuto. He appointed 3 of Ntuzwa's half-brothers, Siteku, Dabulumanzi, and Shingana, as his lieutenants. The younger Ufalaza Ubuto was standing ready, but some had already risen to escort their womenfolk to safety. Another Amabuto, the Inondwengu, were more than 12 kilometers away to the northwest of Ondini. They would never arrive in time to help defend the capital, although their commander, Sekatwayo, was now standing alongside Cetshwayo. Many members of the Amabuto streamed out eastwards towards the oncoming Mantlakazi. Young commanders were in charge. Their elders were still hustling to catch up, and the Usutu straggling along the valley with Ufalaza on the left, Donkliyo and the Ngomamakosi on the right. The rest, including the Utuwana, Udloku, Mkapu, and Unuhlenke in the middle, all had white cowtail decorations, the Mishokobezi, meaning rebels, They rebelled against the British by joining Cetshwayo. For them, the Matlakazi were the Amabuka, the deserters who'd left the king's cause. At 8 a.m., the Matlakazi warriors appeared along the Umtanuntangwayo Ridge, the sun behind them, black silhouettes adding a tinge of drama to the heavy moment. The Mkliyu and the Ngumamakosi raised their rifles and opened fire, but the Matlakazi were way out of range. Without waiting for further orders, the Matlakazi sounded their terrifying battle cry, Washesha, which means hurry or go quickly in a direct translation. But yelled in their thousands in this situation, the meaning was far more like, finish them off. Then they swept in on a great outflanking movement. The Mkliyu and Ngumamakosi were in no mood to be finished off. They broke and stampeded southwest, right past the nonplussed king at Undini and into the broken bush, ignoring runners sent by Cetshwayo, ordering them to stand and fight. The Matlakazi left horn, most of the center, followed these fleeing warriors past the great place. Meanwhile, the Usutu center and left had tried to fight back, remaining in place near Umtanuntangwayo Ridge, firing more steadily. But when they saw that the Matlakazi weren't stopping, they turned and fled west over the open ground in front of Undini. Some of the Utuwana stopped there, perhaps shaken by the brazen cowardice. Most died then in hand-to-hand fighting. Soon the whole Mahlabatini plain was covered in smoke and flames. Every ikanda was ablaze. Zibebu's men destroyed everything in sight. The veld caught fire. It was midwinter dry. An apocalyptic vision developed as the civilians streamed away. Warriors were cut down. Animals lowing, dogs barking. Chaos. Cetshwayo was in big trouble. There was help on its way. A mixed force of the Xolusi, the Buthelezi, and Northern Usutu under Indabuko, who had set out south across the Black Umfolozi upon hearing that Zibebu was on his way. And suddenly the force turned back kilometers from Undini when they saw that the veld was ablaze and the king's army had disintegrated. Some of Cetshwayo's inner circle, his women and members of his family, managed to reach Henry Francis Finn Jr.'s camp in the hills to the north of Undini, where they hid in safety. Finn watched as some of the elders he had known since childhood were harried on the plain, cut down, including Cetshwayo, who was elderly and infirm, and Ntuzwa, the Usutu commander. Later, Finn walked among the dead, counting 500 bodies, most experienced warriors in their 40s. There were very few youths. They had managed to run away. The fat-bellied and unfit had been unable to get away and paid the price for the indulgence. 60 men of political importance died that day, weighed down by their own girth, a lifetime of indulgence proving fatal. Included were Sihayu, whose sons had set off the Anglo-Zulu War. In Shingwayo, the Santluana commander himself died. Godide, another senior general. Vumandaba, who'd called the warriors back from Rourke's Drift. Langa chief Ndwandwe, Mbopa of the Hlabisa, Chief Dilikana of the Mbata, Chief Nkandi of the Sibisa, Nkonkwane, who travelled to London with Cetshwayo, all dead. The bloodletting by Zibebu's Matlakazi had achieved what the British columns could not. His men had destroyed the old Zulu order in one terrible morning. And what of Cetshwayo? He managed to get away, abandoning his capital as the fight passed over it like a banshee-flecked cloud. He climbed aboard the only horse left, but it buckled under his weight. He was then forced to flee southeastwards towards the White Umfolozi on foot. At the confluence of the Itukweni and Imbalani streams, he spotted a cluster of trees and he hid while a small group of his household carried on, a decoy because they could hear the Matlakazi behind them. But the pursuers weren't deceived and stood close to the copse of trees and then shouted at Cetshwayo to stand up. A flight of spears flooded towards the king. Two found their mark, both hitting him on his right thigh. Cetshwayo caught sight of one of his attackers, the young son of a Hlabisa chief. That enraged him. Members of Cetshwayo's entourage were now stunned by the king's courage. He walked from the trees straight towards his attackers and shouted, "Do you stab me, Halijana, son of Sumfula? I am your king." The youths were dumbstruck, overawed by this majesty, the profound dignity and power of a man who would not cower. They bent over, crouching in supplication. then gave Cetshwayo his royal salute, and then tended to his wounds. One apologized, saying they had mistaken Cetshwayo for his brother Zuedu. They stood back and let the king go on his way. He hobbled towards the secret cave in a shallow valley down on the left bank of the White Mfolozi, a place Cetshwayo had found as a child while he had herded his father Mpandi's cattle. He was to hunker down here until August 1st, 1883, a month hidden along with four women from the royal house and a young man. Later, he heard of other escapes. Dinizulu, his 15-year-old heir, leapt on a horse and was helped to safety by Chief Dabulumanzi. But Cetshwayo's youngest son, Nyoni Intaba, was speared to death in the arms of his mother. She escaped with a shoulder wound. When Cetshwayo emerged, he made his way to Resident Magistrate Melmoth Osborne's house at Ishowe. There his brother Shingana sent him a horse. He headed upriver through the lands of the iron workers, the iron men called the Tube, along the Mtlatuzi, then upstream and finally settled at the stronghold of Manzipambana, deep in the Nkandla forest, a place not even Shaka had defeated. Dark, steep gorges, sheer ridges, a place of dripping mists and eternal legends. Cetshwayo took refuge here at the Ntlweni homestead built for him by Luhungu of the Shezi. Nearby, more caves, deeper and known to only a few, where he could take cover if Ntlweni was reached. Cetshwayo had come full circle. 4 years earlier, he'd been a fugitive from the British in the Ngomi forest, and he was betrayed there. Would he be betrayed here too? The British had taken him alive in 1789, but his internecine enemy Zubebu had no use for prisoners. He would simply kill Cetshwayo if he caught him, and so the embattled Zulu king was trapped in the picturesque hills of Nkandla. A bit like Jacob Zuma. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, Salagatli.